We often hear these days that New Zealand is and always has been a secular country. Well, in the late 19th century, Dunedin's poet laureate Thomas Graham and then Richard Sidney, King Dick, called it God's own country. But I want to offer some historical reflections tonight on those issues. And I'm going to begin by making some general points about what historians have said about the place and significance of Christianity in New Zealand history. And then I'm going to zoom in and focus closely on southern Dunedin, this area, the southern suburbs of Dunedin, from about 1880 to about 1930, as a kind of a case study, a microcosm. And I hope you'll stay awake enough to ask questions and make comments. I tell my students that you may not always agree with what I have to say, with my historical interpretations, but I aim to keep you awake. Good, roll it down. So, now, I want to talk about, Hugh's provided an ideal introduction. I want to talk about what I see as the dominant way of thinking about the place of Christianity in New Zealand history in the second half of the 20th century, between about the 1950s and the beginning of this millennium. And I want to suggest, I want to characterise those stories in three ways. First, I want to argue that many historians depicted New Zealand as a secular country. So this is my first point, secular New Zealand. And I think the key figure here was Keith Sinclair, Professor of History at Auckland, founder of the New Zealand, one of the major figures in the founding of the New Zealand Historical Association, founder and for many years editor of the New Zealand Journal of History. He really put New Zealand history on the map. He, for reasons my recent research has helped me to understand rather better than I did a few years ago, argued in his Pelican History of New Zealand, first published in 1959, you can still buy it at Auckland Airport. It's been enormously influential. In many ways, it's sort of set the model which most later historians have followed. And he argued that the prevailing religion, 1959, was a simple materialism, in which the pursuit of health and possessions filled more minds than thoughts of salvation. Interestingly, he wrote that in the same year that the Billy Graham Crusade attracted 110,000 people, mostly Aucklanders, to Carlisle Park over two nights. So I guess that was left out of the story. But moreover, he doubted whether the general population was in any sense more religious during the 19th century. In other words, we've basically always been a pretty secular lot. The historian Hugh Jackson, in his book Churches and People in Australia and New Zealand, published in 1987, took for granted the marginal role of organised religion in the 19th century. Now, it was probably relevant that Hugh Jackson was working in Keith Sinclair's department and published a seminal article on church-going in 19th century New Zealand that everybody quoted, in which this phrase appeared. He took for granted the marginal role of organised religion. Now, I can tell you that the very next issue of the New Zealand Journal of History is going to carry an article criticising Jackson's famous article and showing that, in fact, church-going rates were appreciably higher than Jackson recognised, and that the whole subject basically needs to be revisited. It's by my colleague, Alison Clark. Look out for that. Following this sort of Sinclair secular line, my colleague, Eric Olson, writing in the Oxford History of New Zealand, first published in 1981, second edition 1982, argued that over 70% did not attend church as early as 1881, and then crisis hit the Protestant churches early in the 20th century when dogma disintegrated and the Protestant churches lost authority. So it's they started marginal enough, but crisis hit in the early 20th century and society was highly secular from then on. And in many ways, more recent historians, James Belcher, have basically followed in this way of seeing things. In his Paradise Reforged, appearing in 2001, Belcher argues that the 50 years between 1880 and 1930, now these are the years I'm going to be concentrating on in my look at Southern Dunedin, so it'll be a great test case. He argued that the great tightening of these years, he believes that that's a formative half century in which a sort of a loose, boozy, bloke-dominated frontier society, which was kind of a bit dysfunctional lots of ways, tightened up, became a lot more cohesive, more disciplined, so on and so forth. He calls that the great tightening. And he insists that it was a mainly secular crusade. Okay? Religious forces were there, but ultimately not that important. A mainly secular crusade. Now, I want to unpack secular New Zealand a bit more because it rested on a couple of assumptions. And they are what I'm going to call, in short, the lapsed masses and its corollary, the middle class churches, the thesis. That is to say, the idea that the working class people had basically lapsed, and that implied that those people who did actually attend church, have some relationship with organised religion, were middle class. And so, Sinclair, a labourer was almost never seen in church. Clear statement of the lapsed masses. Similarly, Eric, the Oxford History, the middle classes dominated all the churches from which working men had defected in droves. Peter Gibbons, also writing the Oxford History, the churches lay firmly in the hands of the ruling classes. You can see there's a sort of a, there's probably a sort of a Marxist tinge, a sort of a socialist tinge to that perspective. It's important to note that Eric's excellent research on Caversham in a couple of books weakened that lapsed masses thesis. And so, Eric's book on Caversham between 1880 and 1920, Building the New World, appearing in 1995, showed that skilled workers, so skilled working class occupations, and middle class folks, dominated the male membership of the Protestant churches of Caversham, the suburb of Caversham, in that period. But he highlighted the virtual absence of the unskilled workers, and there were a good proportion of them, from all Protestant churches. So we've got a weaker version of the lapsed masses. It's actually, it's now the lapsed unskilled. But you can see that the lapsed masses, if the working classes constitute somewhere between 50 and 60% of all workers, if they've all turned their backs on the churches, society is bound to be reasonably secular. You can see the relation between those two theses. And the third I call, for short, to be a wee bit provocative, bad religion. And here's some recent research that I've just published in a little article in the Journal of New Zealand Literature. Now this thesis actually has 19th century roots, but it really takes off among historians and social scientists in the 1950s. And that's partly because Sinclair's fellow historian, trained at Auckland University in the late 1940s, R.M. Chapman, Robert Chapman, who later becomes a very eminent political scientist, also at Auckland University, publishes a famous article in Landfall in 1953 called Fiction and the Social Pattern. And in that article, he uses literary evidence gleaned from New Zealand novels, short stories and poems, and weaves that together with evidence from historians, mostly historians writing about British history, but also a little bit of New Zealand stuff, to argue that Puritanism brought to New Zealand by the British churches was the root of almost all evil in New Zealand. That is to say, virtually all of our problems, personal, interpersonal, his list was astonishing. If you doubt me, go ahead and read it. Female frigidity, patriarchy, depression, suicide, family dysfunction. Did I say patriarchy already? Matriarchy as well. The list of almost everything that's gone wrong with this country, we owe it to the Puritanism that infects us. And that Puritanism came here from the churches. And he singles out the Anglican Church and the Presbyterian, the Free Church Presbyterians, who founded Otago, as the sort of worst culprits, but the Methodists and the Catholics, you know, largely reinforce the pattern. They don't overturn it. And this recent article that I referred to shows, I think, that there's a fascinating peculiarity about New Zealand historians. Most of the really significant and influential ones from the days of William Pembrey in the 19th century to today have also been poets. Chapman was a poet. Keith Sinclair was a published poet. My old mentor at Massey University, Bill Oliver, was a published poet. And they were immersed, all three of them. Two of them became the most influential historians in the second half of the 20th century in this country. All three of them were immersed in the literary culture of the country in the 1950s, and in that literary culture, amongst novelists, short story writers and poets, this war against Puritanism was raging furiously and had been since the 1930s. And this crusade, I use the word advisedly, was spearheaded by Alan Curnow, Frank Targeson, A.R.D. Fairbairn, and Dennis Glover. They were the kind of leading figures. And my argument is that Chapman and Sinclair, in particular, colleagues in the Auckland History Department, before in 1964 Chapman becomes Foundation Professor of Political Science at Auckland, they translate this anti-Puritanism from the literary world into history and the social sciences. And so, it's not surprising that you get Sinclair's Pelican History saying things like missionary ideas were as destructive of Maori society as bullets. And he's talking about the Anglican evangelicals of the CMS. It's no wonder, I suggest, he describes the Reverend Thomas Burns, first minister of the Otago settlement, as a censorious old bigot. A lovely example of value-free social science. And I think in many ways, here, the pattern is set, and it's largely followed. My colleague, Eric Olson, writing with his then-wife, André Levesque, on the origins of the European family in New Zealand, argued that the Puritan legions, their phrase, imposed codes of sexual purity, temperance and domesticity on 1920s New Zealand. My colleague Barbara Brooks argued in a New Zealand Journal History article that the Government Committee of Inquiry into Abortion in 1936-37 turned to the church to counter the feminists and political radicals trying to liberalise access to abortion. Now, the point I'm making, I'm not siding with one side or the other here. The simple point that I'm making in reviewing this historiography is that it can't have been the case that New Zealand was a highly secular society in which religion didn't matter much at all as early as the 1880s. And yet, the church played a powerful culture-shaping and political role in the 1930s, 1920s and 30s. Both can't be true. Secular New Zealand and bad religion can't be true. Can't both be true. That's my point. Okay, a quick, this is a plate taken from the New Zealand Historical Atlas. Just quickly looking at church adherence and attendance from 1858 to 1991, most of our history, and just a few quick points. Well over 90% of the population for virtually all of this period, it's starting to decline a bit by the end of the period, but the vast majority of New Zealanders identify with some, denomination, certainly in the 19th century, and that pattern basically continues up until the 1970s. It's important to disaggregate church going by denomination. And it probably won't surprise you to learn that Anglicans were the least regular church attenders of the major denominations. That wasn't a peculiarly New Zealand phenomenon. That was standard practice in back in England and had been for quite some time by this stage. But I simply disagree with the claim, and this article about to appear will show how wrong the claim is, made in the Oxford History of New Zealand, that 70% did not attend church in 1881. I think that's deeply misleading. In fact, I've actually been conservative. My colleague estimates that somewhere between 30 and 35% of adults usually attend church, in other words, on a pretty regular weekly basis. A much larger proportion attend occasionally, less regularly, maybe once a month. Between roughly 70%, it varies depending on the region. Down south here is thanks to all the Presbyterians, is kind of New Zealand's Bible Belt. I mean, it really is a distinctive region. But roughly 70% of Protestant parents send their children to Sunday school, and that's a pattern that continues into the 1970s. That really begins to break down only in the late 1960s, early 70s. So that I think there's no question but that most New Zealand families until quite recently were in regular or at least occasional contact with some church. Now, we're zooming into the southern suburbs of Dunedin. We're getting to our case study. It seems to me that this area is an excellent case study in which to test some of the prevailing wisdom. Well, let's see if it's right. Because by about 1890, which is slightly before, southern Dunedin is the most densely populated, highly industrialized urban area in the country. So, it should be a good place in which to test out the secular New Zealand, the lapsed masses, and the bad religion theses. Yeah? That's what we're going to do. Now, it's conventionally been described as growing increasingly godless from the 1880s. And some have suggested that in many ways the kind of radically secular working class consciousness that takes hold in southern Dunedin in the 1880s spreads. So in other words, modern secular New Zealand is actually born here. And one of the chief exhibits for this case has been Samuel Lister, who has been depicted in the existing literature. He was the founding editor of the Otago Workman and Forbury News, a newspaper that started in 1887 and flourished through the 1890s. He has a lot to say about every hot topic, and I'll be looking a little bit more at what he has to say. But previous historians have suggested that Lister's Otago Workman attacked the churches and galvanised the emergence of a defiantly secular, anti-clerical, and indeed atheistic working class consciousness, not only in Dunedin, but also beyond. So, he's an interesting character. Now, we got our researcher in the Caversham project to give you an idea of... here's an interesting contrast between South Dunedin, the boroughs of South Dunedin and Caversham, and Mornington. Mornington, four churches, no pubs. These southern suburbs, you can see plenty of churches, various kinds, also plenty of pubs. Keep that in mind as the story goes on. Now, here's our man, fascinating character, Sam Lister. Here's Dunedin's Karl Marx. Or is he? And there he is. With his wife Jane, dressmaker, and one of their, they eventually have 10 kids. Only eight of them survive, a couple of them die. And look at the picture, and can I suggest, is it too naughty of me to suggest that he looks like quite a fierce fellow, does he? The proud Scottish patriarch, she looks like a very meek and mild and submissive wife, doesn't she? Well, we'll see.
He's a redhead to me.
Sorry?
Looks like he's a redhead to me.
He might be a ginger. he's a fiery character. Yeah, he's a fascinating fellow. I'm fascinated by Sam. Okay, so here are some of the questions that I want to ask. So how well, actually, were working class men represented in the churches of this area? Because we looked carefully at 15. The fact of the matter was, when Keith Sinclair was writing, we didn't know. His argument that the working classes had lapsed reflected the conventional wisdom in British historical writing at that time. Well, actually, things have changed a lot in British historiography, but New Zealand historians have tended not to keep up. So these are the sorts of questions that we need to ask. And the second question, well, had unskilled working men lapsed on that? What about the whole gender thing? When we're talking about the lapsed masses, do we mean blokes more than females, women and girls? Were working class women and girls more likely to be involved and active in the churches than their menfolk? Well, that's a question that needs to be asked. Furthermore, did what British historians have called diffusive Christianity, Christianity among occasional churchgoers, people who'd been maybe baptised Anglican and didn't have much, maybe got married, but didn't have much to do with churches, how do we describe those folks? So those are the sorts of questions our research asked. Now, here's a nice map drawn up by our research assistant, just listing the various churches and their dates. And it does give you a good impression that there were plenty of churches of all kinds, and we obtained the records of 15 of them, as many as we could, and just did some record linking, and I'll give you some of the results here. Now, just to give an idea, first of all, of the religious ecology of the southern suburbs. You know, who dominate the area religiously? Well, you can see that the white bar graph refers to the total number of Baptists in the country as a whole. And I can tell you that that's, for the 1891 census, that's about 2.5%. So you can see there's a heck of a lot of Baptists in southern Dunedin.
Praise the Lord.
I'm with you, brother.
Presbyterians. Around about 24-25% in the country as a whole, you can see, as you'd expect, there are a larger proportion here in the southern suburbs, and the far south is, of course, heavily Presbyterian. Catholics, they're about slightly above their national average of roughly 14% in the nation as a whole, slightly more. There's a particular concentration in South Dunedin, the borough of South Dunedin, and they're clustered around the Basilica and the school, for obvious reasons. Congregationalists are about right. Object to state, well, there's actually slightly fewer. Objectors have, of course, grown very rapidly in the last few decades. C of E in Protestant not defined. Fascinating. I love these. I love the census categories. Of course, part of the problem is they change over time. So, but everybody who calls himself a Protestant and doesn't go any further gets lumped in with the Anglicans. And you can see one of the important things is that although that compared with the nation as a whole, Anglicans are roughly 42%. Of the nation as a whole at the end of the 19th century, you can see they are appreciably less numerous in Dunedin and indeed the southern suburbs. You can see they're only about roughly 32%. Pagans, there's a few of those. Interestingly, in the next census, the 96th census, they disappear. And they get reclassified as Buddhists, Confucians, etc. It's the Chinese. Methodists, we'll hear a bit about them. Interestingly, there are somewhat fewer Methodists here. I found that there's a bit of toing and froing between the Methodists and the Baptists. You've got to watch out for that, Rolly. in the 1890s, for a reason, I suspect there were probably ructions in one or the other congregation.
In the Baptist.
They
had split in 1884, was it, Martin? 1884, you said?
I should have brought my tape recorder.
My wife's ancestors were with the split.
Ah, interesting. I'd like to hear more about that. Yeah, good. Thank you. Okay. So, you get some idea of the religious ecology of the place.
Can you talk about primitive Methodist?
Sorry?
Primitive Methodist. It's not on there, but it was on the other.
There was a primitive Methodist congregation in the area. Yeah, there certainly was. They must have gotten lumped into the general Methodist category here. Now, on the left, you'll see, hopefully it's big enough for you to see, the various congregations we studied. And here we have unskilled workers as a proportion of all those affiliated to the particular congregations we studied. And the question was, so were the unskilled workers all never darken the door of the church? Well, answer, no, actually. You can see that the Salvation Army had easily the highest proportion of unskilled. This is working men. Okay, this is working men. You can see that Kensington Presbyterian also had a very high proportion of unskilled working men, as you'd expect. St. Patrick's Catholics, large numbers of unskilled. Look at St. Peter's. Quite significant numbers of unskilled in baptismal records. I'm not surprised about that. And so on down. You can see that St. Clair, established very late in the period, doesn't have any unskilled at all. But St. Clair is the exception that proves the rule. Now, the proportion of unskilled working in Southern Dunedin as a whole is down the bottom. So that's the key comparison. And you can see it's about 23-24%. You can see that, if you take a straight line up, you can see that a reasonable number of churches are below that, have fewer, a smaller proportion of unskilled men than in the area as a whole, but you can see a reasonable number have greater proportions. They are certainly not absent from the congregations. Skilled workers, similarly. That's not surprising. And you can, for the area as a whole, you can see skilled workers are roughly 32-33%, and you can see that most of the congregations we studied have a larger proportion of skilled working men in the congregation than in the area as a whole. So they are a powerful force in the churches. If we collapse the occupational groups into three, upper, middle, and manual, upper class occupations, middle, and manual occupations, we see that the churches, this graph, almost exactly mirror the study area as a whole. I think that's not surprising. Now, what happens if we add women? Well, very interesting. We've only done this for in a few congregations. It's quite a time-consuming process. But we've done it for Kensington Presbyterian. Remember that that had quite a high proportion of unskilled working men? Well, add women, and we're not talking about female occupations necessarily. In some cases we are. But we've identified female occupation where it's not otherwise specified, or you know, we simply can't ascertain it, with the nearest relative, husband or father. And we discovered that the working class proportion of the unskilled manual proportion, and indeed the dark grey is the skilled, rose. So women from unskilled families, sorry, from working class families with a skilled, unskilled, semi-skilled, were more likely to be in church than their menfolk, even more likely. Similarly, with St. Clair Methodist, and women and the working class occupations rise. Similarly with South Dunedin Baptist, similar story. We haven't done it for the Anglicans yet, but we'll let you know when that happens. Now, I've given you some quantitative data, and now I want to try and make sense of it in terms of some of the big and controversial issues of the period 1880s to 1910s. First, by looking at the anti-sweating campaign, which really gets going, sparked, the global context is, of course, the Long Depression that lasts from roughly mid-1870s to the mid-1890s. And this hits home here in the clothing industry in 1887-88. Competition, international competition, puts pressure on employers in the clothing industry to cut costs by cutting wages. They do. They cut wages in 1887 and again in 1888. They lay off skilled male workers who they have to pay decently, and they hire more female and boy labour. Rutherford Waddell, the minister of St Andrew's Presbyterian Church, preaches his famous sermon, The Sin of Cheapness, to expose what's going on in the clothing industry in October 1888, early October. I'm fairly sure that he wants some non-minister to lead the anti-sweating campaign. Nobody steps forward. He steps in and leads what is a very powerful anti-sweating campaign that lasts from 1888 to 1894, spreads throughout the country. News of his sermon gets taken around the country. A lot of people are concerned that the exploitation of decent working people, especially working women, should not happen in God's own country. This is one of the old world evils that we need to leave behind in this country. And the fascinating point about the anti-sweating campaign in Dunedin is that it's thanks partly to Waddell, who has a great capacity for getting on with people. He can get on with all sorts of people. He can work with all sorts of people. He's quite ecumenical. The anti-sweating campaign is amazingly ecumenical. Church folk from every imaginable church climb on board, and it's also cross-class. It gets a lot of support from work people, obviously, but also from middle-class folks. And one of the key people, I'm going to show you a picture in a minute, of some of the key players. One of the ones that I've left out of the photo you're about to see There's an interesting guy about whom more later, Henry Fish, Henry Smith Fish, several times Mayor of Dunedin, an Anglican, less than nominal Anglican. Sam Lister thinks he's a very nominal Anglican. thinks his real place of worship is the pub. And Fish is a very interesting character, big player in Dunedin politics. He also represents Dunedin in Parliament right through the 1880s and 1890s, and he's the chief parliamentary lobbyist for the liquor trade. Keep that in mind. But he's very much on board with the anti-sweating campaign. Now here's Waddell. This is from a later period. Here he is in his pulpit at St Andrews. This is from a later period. At this stage, Kensington Presbyterian Church, which appeared in our stats, is actually part of his parish. So his parish extends into this area. So he's really an interesting and important figure. By the time this appears, he's a well-known figure nationally. I think in many ways he's the most... certainly one of the most well-known Protestant ministers in the country.
When was the Kensington Church
built? I'm not entirely sure about that. Yeah. I don't know enough about its history. I do have a photo somewhere of its Sunday school, so it must have been there somewhere. I just don't know what happened to it in the 20th century.
Wasn't it on your map fairly early on?
Can I look it up at the end? Just because I don't want to lose my place. So there's Waddell, who's leading this anti-sweating campaign. Born and raised in Northern Ireland. He's a Northern Irish Presbyterian, but a remarkable character. Who has a real feeling for the outsider. And this has been evident in Northern Ireland, even before he comes here. One of his good mates, good friends in Dunedin, is Robert Stout, the freethinker, from a Presbyterian background. And Waddell works with Stout in a range of causes, as we'll see. Now, here are some of the leading players, most of them are locals, in the new anti-sweating campaign. Just a few faces. Leonard Monk Isaac, a leading Methodist minister. He had actually worked as a young man in the clothing trade in Dunedin in the 1870s. And the Methodist Conference was meeting in Dunedin just after Waddell's sermon, and he helped throw the Methodists behind the anti-sweating campaign. They came out with a strong resolution in support of it. There's George Fenwick, the ODT. He's very much behind it. On the right, Henry Shacklock. Now, I can't quite figure out his churchmanship. He sometimes calls himself a Congregationalist. I know he's got Baptist connections as well. I think he moves around a bit. But he's very much in behind anti-sweating. There's Robert Stout, firmly in the campaign. Here's Rachel Reynolds, about whom more in a second.
Kindergarten.
Reynolds Kindergarten. She's a stalwart of St Andrew's Presbyterian, one of Waddell's right-hand women, a very, very important person. There's Harriet Morrison. Now, she's from a Bible Christian background. Bible Christians are a kind of a working-class Methodist group. She's a lay preacher, she's a preacher woman, and she is a key player in the anti-sweating campaign and in the foundation of the first New Zealand female union, the Tailoresses Union, that comes out of the anti-sweating campaign. Waddell works with her closely on this campaign and served as honorary vice president of the Tailoresses Union for about 6 months. Very, very interesting. Bendix Hellenstein Clothing Company, he supports the anti-sweating campaign. We are not going to live by the misery and degradation of working people, he says. He is a fascinating character. William Hutchison, a unionist, a union leader, and a Presbyterian elder, who says business people must not pray for their workers on Sunday and pray on them Monday through Friday. And here, even Bishop Patrick Moran, Catholic Bishop of Dunedin, who is very much behind the anti-sweating campaign, strongly behind the anti-sweating campaign, makes it very clear in the tablet, this is a very good cause. We fully support it. It's not the only time he and Waddell cooperate. Very interesting. But a quick word about Harriet Morrison. She's such an interesting figure. She grows up in Caversham. In fact, I discovered plugging her name into the search engine for Papers Past. Tragically, as a 14-year-old, she was running an errand for her mother, took a shortcut home one evening, and was subject to an attempted rape by sort of a vagrant Italian labourer. She never married, and she became a leading unionist and first wave feminist. Very strong votes for women. To build a society safer for women and children and families. So I just listed some of her campaigns there. There she is there with a bunch of other unionists. And she's a leading figure in the Dunedin franchise campaign. Dunedin's the centre of the national franchise campaign. It's really the heart and soul. It's the big smoke in the late 19th century. And she's a leading figure in it. She's a fascinating character. And she founds the Women's Franchise League in 1892 with her friend Helen Nicol, a strong Presbyterian woman. Now, here's the important point. What is remarkably united, ecumenical, and cross-class coalition over the anti-sweating campaign, during the anti-sweating campaign in the late 1880s, fractures and divides in the early 1890s over two closely related issues. Prohibition, the booze issue, an issue that we obviously have got all sorted out today, and also suffrage, votes for women. And these two were in fact closely connected. Rutherford Waddell, interestingly, leads the Temperance Party. That's what they call themselves. In fact, they're prohibitionists. They believe, Waddell believes, that although he's not himself a hardliner, he believes that alcohol abuse is so destructive, particularly for poorer women and children, that we have to take a tough line. And so he leads the he's the senior Presbyterian leader of the so-called Temperance Party, and it's dominated in Dunedin by evangelical Protestants. Waddell's the leader, but his good friend John Wesley Jago, who is editor of the Evening Star newspaper and also edits The Prohibitionist, the flagship publication of the Prohibition movement, based in Dunedin, very important fellow. Now, Robert Stout's not an evangelical, he's a freethinker, but it's interesting that he joins evangelicals on a range of controversial issues, and he's certainly a gung-ho prohibitionist. He basically thinks like his friend Waddell on this. But they clash repeatedly and fiercely with the so-called moderate party, as they call themselves. Sounds sensible though, and so on. And the moderates want minimal changes to drinking legislation and drinking culture. And the so-called moderate party is led locally by Roman Catholics, such as John Carroll, after whom Carroll Street, which was Walker Street, which was where Waddell had his church, was renamed after John Carroll. He became Dunedin's first Catholic mayor, and he'd been a publican. There are a number of prominent Dunedin Anglicans in the moderate party. Henry Fish, a leading figure. William Dawson, manager of Spates Brewery. Charles Greenslade, after whom the firm's still going, he's a pillar of St. Paul's. Actually, it should be Canon Robert Loftus Stanford, a trained lawyer who'd been at All Saints. He's also a leading moderate, and they have some Jewish supporters too, notably Morris Joel, a brewer. Now, many of the moderate party have strong links with the Licensed Victuallers Association, who are a powerful political force in Dunedin politics, and of course have strong connections with the liquor trade. I've already mentioned that Fish is the chief lobbyist in Parliament for the liquor trade. So you can see that there are some very interesting, by 1891-92, very interesting rifts, broadly speaking, between activist evangelical Protestants and people in the Episcopal churches, Catholics and Anglicans, and with some Jewish supporters. Those debates, there's a fascinating meeting in the Dunedin Town Hall in 1892, in which these two groups go at it. The first group actually wins more popular support. The mayor tries to chair the meeting. It is almost total chaos. People are being yelled at, shouted down. Waddell gets up to speak by popular acclaim, says what he has to say, tries to continue speaking, and he's drowned out so long that he eventually stops trying and sits down. He can't make headway. You know, massive tensions. And of course, female suffrage gets caught up in these tensions with the campaign for votes for women. The Dunedin WCTU, Women's Christian Temperance Union, has been founded in 1885 after a visit from an American missionary, female missionary, Mary Levitt. She gets a very enthusiastic response locally, and the Dunedin WCTU, which quickly establishes branches around Otago, especially where Presbyterianism is strong, is dominated here in the city by Presbyterians, Methodists and Baptists. There's also a few Brethren women, interestingly. And they campaign, among other things, they campaign for a range of causes, but their favourite causes include prohibition, Bible in schools, and votes for women. So although they're called the Temperance Union, they're actually prohibitionists. Their leading male supporters here are prohibitionists. Waddell, Stout, Jago. They're some of the leaders, there are others. In other words, there are very strong links between the prohibition movement and the female suffrage movement. Not surprisingly, you might figure, they excite fierce opposition from blokes such as Sam Lister and the Otago Workmen, the Mayor Henry Smith Fish, who's speaking for the liquor trade, who believe quite rightly that their profits will be greatly reduced if the prohibitionists get their way, and also Bishop Moran in the Tablet. He approves of neither prohibition nor female suffrage, partly because of through a link in his mind. Now, a crucial incident happens in 1892. As the prohibitionists swing their movement behind female suffrage, the male critics get alarmed, and Henry Fish decides that if women get the vote, we could be in trouble. And he pays people to take petitions around the streets of Dunedin, including southern Dunedin. He wants people to sign a petition, but he's a bit tricky. He gets his canvas and says, you're signing for female suffrage. But it's actually an anti-suffrage campaign he's hawking out. And his canvases, and he himself, don't tell signers. When the feminists and their supporters get wind of what he's up to, they expose what he's doing in the press. This is absolutely crucial in helping to explain why in 1892, 57% of the women, the eligible women, adult women of southern Dunedin, sign the suffrage petition. That's a far higher proportion than elsewhere in Dunedin, than in any other part of New Zealand. In other words, quite inadvertently, Henry Fish and his mates have helped turn southern Dunedin into a world-leading first-wave feminist community. we've been able to identify the churches of many of these signatories, not all of them. They tend to be evangelical Protestants, Presbyterians, Baptists, Methodists. We found at least 18 Catholic women signed. In other words, they did what their bishop told them not to do. They ignored Moran. I think they I've got some evidence for this. I think it's quite likely that they chatted to their female friends across the fence. Are you going to sign? Yeah, I'll sign too. I think that's probably how it worked. But as far as we can tell, not many Anglican women in the area signed. And I think that fits the kind of general pattern we're seeing. Well, we do know what Sam Lister feels about what's going on, and he's absolutely horrified. The Otago Workman explodes in fury at these tabbies, as he calls the female suffragists. He sometimes calls them unbreeched men or male women. He also goes after their male supporters, people like Waddell, Jago and Stout. He calls them female men or goody-goody weaklings. Fascinating stuff. In other words, they're not real red-blooded blokes. The fascinating thing is that Sam Lister is up against it. He can't even control his own women folk. His meek and mild little wifey Jane signs the suffrage petition. We have her signature there. She ignores her husband. And she's actually an extremely active Presbyterian churchwoman. In fact, Sam is actually quite hilarious. He writes this column, she's so busy going to Bible studies at the minister's house. The minister may be whatever. We're not sure. It's possible. Doing home missionary work, 3 afternoons a week. But he says he's having to dress and scrub his little flock of children. Mend their clothes without a murmur, and love, honour, and obey his all too absent life. It's just hilarious. And she supports votes for women, Bible schools, and prohibition, all causes anathema to her husband. These sorts of tensions don't go away. They're not confined to Dunedin. They continue to circulate nationally. And I'm just going to finish by showing you some truth cartoons. The newspaper Truth gets founded in the country in 1907. It's actually founded by an Australian newspaperman called John Norton. And he's actually an Anglican. And it's not surprising that he doesn't have any time for prohibitionists and first wave feminists, and they're frequently the subjects of hostile cartoons such as this one from 1914, beginning of the war, here's the prohibition high priest. Don't let this big ugly cat called prohibition out of the bag, because with this tabby, all these other nasty cats will follow. You can probably just see no mixed bathing, no smoking. I haven't got my glasses on, so I can't see what that says. But you get the picture. Same cartoonist. This is a very interesting one. Particularly if you look at the language. If the Puritan, here's the Puritan, becomes the boss denizen, starts to run the country, goodbye to free speech, free press, and free men. And what you see depicted here is what Truth and the Otago Workmen regard as this unholy alliance between the Puritan, the female man, and the male women, the tabbies, the unbreeched men here. Here depicted as a sort of a dubious old woman, notice that she's picking the pocket of the would-be politician, the would-be MP. She's already got his pocket watch. She's stolen it, and it's labelled Freedom of Action, and she's searching for something more. And these two are holding the country, are trying to hold the country to ransom. And we have to be vigilant, otherwise we're in serious trouble. Notice the implication that that the prohibitionists are hypocrites. She's stealing his watch. It's no place for the faint-hearted, the public sphere. Similarly, when 6 o'clock closing arrives, Truth is not at all impressed. And here are all the wowsers. You can see they're depicted as non-conformist ministers. Curiously, Truth actually uses that word, non-conformist, even though technically it doesn't apply in New Zealand where there's no established church. But it's as though Truth is still living in old England. And I think a lot of New Zealanders at that time were still living in a sort of a British world. And these sorts of contests between sort of non-conformists and Anglicans are a carryover from England. They don't disappear here. Again, look at the labels. What's that? Bigotry, cant, hypocrisy, intolerance, and here's good Mr. New Zealand, he's hamstrung by the wowsers. Now, what I'm suggesting is that in Tritt's opinion, it's not that New Zealand is too secular, it's not nearly secular enough. All these people are having far too much influence on public culture, on politics, trying to hold the country to ransom, so on and so forth. Here's my favourite one. My suggested type, again, is the truth, about the same period. I call it Calvin's Land. Now, you notice there's a report that the population of New Zealand has dropped in the last year by several thousand. Truth knows why. The fact is, Australia is a glorious land of liberty, whereas New Zealand is Calvin's land. It's dominated by all these dreadful Puritans. No Sunday trams, no bathing. Here's the big lineup of people stretching from Auckland to Wellington, about to leave for Australia, being driven out by these anti-New Zealanders. Notice there's a couple of them in the North Island, but they're thick on the ground in the South Island, especially in the far south. And you can guess there's quite a few of them here in New Zealand, in Dunedin, sorry. And no smoking, depart ye cursed, no liquor, prohibition. Invercargill prohibitionist. Now, I think that I've said more than enough, and hopefully I've provoked you into a bit of rethinking, but I do suggest to you to link the two halves of my talk, that the great anti-Puritan campaign of the literary figures in the 19th, which gets translated into history and the social sciences in the 1950s and 60s by people like Sinclair and Chapman and so on, is a lot more comprehensible given the sort of background I've just described.